Today's date is August 13, 1997. The speaker is Carol Berkland. The subject is Genocide in Rwanda. What really happened and how Lutherans helped. Number one.
When I knew I was going to come here, I thought, why do we want to talk about this situation that happened some time ago? It's ancient history. But then, knowing what I know now about what happened and why it happened, and having some idea of the fact that it was very much misunderstood when it was taking place, I thought it would be a good idea to go into a deeper discussion of it. I think that most people really don't understand what happened there and why. And I also think that some of the misconceptions, many of the misconceptions or misunderstandings, confirm a rather negative view of Africans, which in most cases are not true. Much of what we know about Africa comes to us from television and from the media. And in the last years, unfortunately, most of that has been very negative. The only time the TV cameras go to Africa seems to be when people are starving or when there's some other kind of disaster going on. So that's the only image we have of Africa. We don't understand that in many places, for example, a success story is in Zimbabwe. Another success story, I hope, is in South Africa. In Mozambique, there's been a civil war for many years. That's now over. Elections have taken place. It's a difficult situation. But this whole southern cone of Africa seems to be really on the verge of the beginning of some good history after many, many years of not very good history. The same thing we're now hoping for Angola. There's been a civil war there. Right now, one of the major things that the LWF is trying to do is there's still a lot of Angolan refugees sitting here in Zambia hoping to repatriate. Refugees are not stupid people. They have left their country and most of them want to go back, but they don't want to go back until they are pretty sure of what they're going to go back to. We found this out in Mozambique when the refugees were in Zimbabwe and Malawi and South Africa. They waited. Even though there was a so-called peace accord, they waited in those refugee camps because at least in the refugee camps they had food, they had shelter. In some cases, if there were refugee camps that the LWF was working with, we were giving them education, we were giving them the skills that they would need so that when they got home, they could become productive members of society. So now in Angola, they're still waiting. There have been elections, but the political situation is still not very stable, so they're not going to go back, and you can't force them to go back. That's one of the major issues we've learned. Well, anyway, back to Rwanda. So there are some positive things happening, but what we saw in the news about Rwanda in the beginning, I think, was very misleading. I don't know. Well, first of all, let's look at, you know where Rwanda is? There's an area here which we now call the Great Lakes region. The greatest lake, of course, being Lake Victoria, but surrounded by a number of other another lakes here. We call the region, Great Lakes region is Uganda, Rwanda, Burundi, Tanzania. Certainly now, even this map is now out of date. It's still called Zaire, but you know now it's called Democratic Republic of the Congo or something like that. I'm not sure exactly the name now. But anyway, here you find Rwanda and Burundi, two very, very small countries, two of the smallest countries in the world, with a very, very high population density, one of the highest densities, I think something like 400 people to a square kilometer, which is pretty high density of population. Though not a country that is not rich necessarily in minerals or natural resources, but not a country prone to drought or anything like that. So there's not been any drought. Up until the conflict began, there was no drought there. There was not any famine. People were pretty well capable of feeding themselves. I think that we also have to look when we talk about genocide, what is it that we really mean? How do we really define it? And this morning I decided to go and look at the dictionary. And the dictionary describes genocide as the systematic killing of or a program of action intended to destroy a whole national or ethnic group. And I think the most important word there is systematic, that this is a systematic plan of destroying an entire ethnic group. In Cambodia, you saw a genocide as well, but that was not necessarily an ethnic group. There wasn't that kind of ethnic thing in Cambodia. It was in Cambodia, I believe, more to destroy a certain political or a certain social group within the society, meaning the most educated people, et cetera, et cetera. Okay. Let's begin with some very bad statistics about this whole thing. First of all, what it cost in human lives. The fact is that in a period of 3 months, from April until June of 1994, it is estimated that 500,000 to 800,000 people were killed in Rwanda. That was the result of both the genocide and the civil war that happened after the genocide began. Large numbers of people were physically and psychologically afflicted. Many women were raped. There was a lot of other kind of trauma. And then over 2 million people fled to neighboring countries. Maybe as half, about half of the Rwandan population. It was incredible. The human suffering was really incomprehensible. I don't know when you remember hearing first about what was happening there, but I was sitting in the LWF office in Geneva, right across the hall from the man who was responsible for emergency work in our office. And I happened to overhear him on the telephone. We had heard that there were a lot of bodies that were starting to be seen coming down a river. There's a right here on the border between Tanzania and Uganda is the Kagera River, which flows into Lake Victoria. We in the LWF have had a big program in Tanzania for many, many years. And we had known that something bad was going to happen in Rwanda. We didn't know that it was going to be this bad. But we had sent some people up here to this area around Ngara and up here in the north. And they came back with reports that these bodies were floating down the river, and nobody knew exactly what was happening. I overheard the phone conversation with my colleague who happened to be Danish. And what he was asking for, I mean, I was just shocked when I heard it, because what was being asked of us was to find some people who were skilled in mountaineering so that they could go up to this area and literally start pulling the bodies out of the water, which had been caught in rocks, you know. And I thought, my goodness, what in the world is happening here? We eventually did that. One of the other things that the LWF did as a result of this was so many bodies were coming down the river and flowing into Lake Victoria, which of course is a huge lake here, that the fishermen in Lake Victoria were very concerned about the sanitary situation, because they thought it might negatively affect their fishing industry. What happened is, again, LWF has a program. We have a field office in Uganda. So we got together some people, and I think it was the U.S. government, USAID, the Uganda government went to USAID and asked if there could be some funds given to clear the bodies from the lake. And that money came to the government of Uganda, and then, of course, the Ugandan government had to find somebody to do the task, and it came to us to do that. So we gathered a group of 40, 50 people together. There were other groups who also did this, but we were one of them, at least to remove the bodies from the lake so that these people could at least be given a decent burial. So I think probably, I've heard the numbers, but I think we buried about 12 to 13,000 bodies that were pulled from the river. If you would like to read something that probably gives the best account of what happened in Rwanda, I would suggest that you read a book called Season of Blood, A Rwandan Journey. It's written by a British journalist named Fergal Keane, and it's just an excellent book. And I'd like to read just a bit from it, because he talks, too, about this beginning genocide. He is standing, I'm reading, he is standing on the bridge. There's a bridge that goes over the Kagera River near here. He says, "Begin with the river. From where I stand near the bridge, it looks like a great soup. It is brown with upland silt and thick with elephant grass. It has come swirling down from the far reaches of the land and is fat with rain. It is pleasantly distracting, so much so that at first I do not notice them. And then I turn around, and for the first time, I see two bodies bobbing along. Then there are three. They nudge in and out of the grass, and the leaves are carried toward the falls. One swirls in toward the bank, and I notice that it is a woman who has been chopped and hacked. But it is not the gash in her head, the gouges in her back and arms that frighten and offend. Rather, I am shocked by her nakedness. Like the others, she is bloated, and her bare body turns and drops and turns and drops in the current. Near the bridge, the current picks up, and I watch her tumble down into the white water, disappearing fast. She comes up again head first and is bounced against the rocks. Don't worry, man, don't be surprised, said my companion. They've been coming through in the hundreds. I look down directly on the falls and see that there are two bodies wedged tight into the rocks. One is that of a man wearing a pair of shorts. He appears to be white, but this is because the days in the water have changed his color. Nearby there is a baby, but I can only make out the head and an arm. The infant is tossed around by the falling water, but is tangled in the weeds that cover the lower part of the rocks. The force of the water is unable to dislodge the baby, and so it bounces up and down in the foam. At this, I turn and walk away from the bridge and quietly take my place in the back of the car." As I said, the human suffering here was really incomprehensible. And what we saw on television was this scene. And I think at the beginning, people thought that this was, again, just this kind of cycle of violence and irrational tribal hatred that you see again and again in Africa. I don't know. Maybe I could ask you, do you remember this, and do you remember what you thought about it? Or has it been so long ago that maybe you were not particularly aware?
I think you feel that nothing ever changes.
Yeah, okay. That this was just another chapter in the long history of Africans kind of irrationally killing each
Except
other.
Except the numbers were so big.
The numbers were right, exactly. Well, one of the another good quote in this book, which I'd like to refer to, is that it seems that where television is concerned, the African news is generally, as I said before, it's only big news when it involves lots of bodies. The higher the mound, the greater the possibility that the world will, however briefly, send its camera teams and correspondents. But once the story has gone stale, that is, that there are no new bodies, and the refugees are down to the trickle, the circus moves on. The images leave us horrified, but largely ignorant. We have, and I think this is very interesting, we have compassion. Certainly, we're moved by what we see and by what we hear, but we don't have very much understanding. What people fail to understand, and this didn't come until sometime later, that this was a well-planned campaign of politically and materially motivated slaughter that came away, that was explained. It was explained as an ancient tribal conflict because the journalists on the ground had moved on before there was time to investigate what had gone on, to investigate properly. This is more true of television than any other media. But several of the world's leading newspapers, including the New York Times and some of the British newspapers, they also bought that line in the initial stages, and they said the killings were just simply a straightforward tribal war. The author of the books clearly, it's a very important thing that he says, that this kind of journalism is driven by stories of horror, but it's markedly lacking in analysis or historical content. And this is one of the things that I've noticed too more since I've been gone from 1991. I come home and I'm really astonished by what passes for news in this country. It's just astonishing. I mean, we in Switzerland can get what is called ABC's World News Tonight or something like that. I don't know. I used to know all those shows, but I don't so much anymore. And what you see is not world news. It has nothing to do with the news. Luckily, we're able to get some national public radio now by satellite. But I think it's really appalling, and it's doing such a disservice to us as a country, which is now called, you know, after the fall of the Soviet Union, the last greatest power in the world. But we're a country that I think more and more is not understanding what is going on in the rest of the world. And I think that's a very serious thing. I heard something the other day that even made me more shocked, and that is that I think about half the members of the current sitting Congress have never had a passport. They've never traveled outside of the United States, and here they are in a position of making very important decisions, but their view of the world is probably not very broad and not very well informed. Anyway, that was a digression. Let's get back to Rwanda. I've told you what it cost in terms of human lives. What it cost in terms of dollars is amazing. During the 9 months of the emergency, between April and December, international assistance for emergency relief to Rwandese refugees and displaced persons is about US dollars, $1.4 billion. That's only 4 months. The situation didn't stop then, of course, because you had all these people sitting in refugee camps. The first great bunch of them, when the Tutsi army that had been gathering up here in Uganda pushed south, then of course the Hutu population ran for their lives. Some of them at the beginning ran across the border into Tanzania. There were about 250,000 that came across the border within a matter of only 24 to 48 hours. 250,000 people left there. Later on, as the Tutsi army was going south, and of course the genocide, they had then seen close up the effects of the genocide, and they were trying as much as possible to take as much land and as much territory so that they could stop the genocide, but most of it had already happened by the time they managed to take Kigali and go further south. Then the biggest group of refugees came over here into Zaire. I think most of you have heard the name Goma, and this is up at the top of this lake. So about 800,000 refugees came across into Goma. It wasn't just a matter of 4 months. Then you had the international community, or especially the UN High Commissioner for Refugees, had to support this massive number of people for at least 2 years. About 2 million people were outside of the country and had to be supported. So the group in Tanzania who were here, they did not go back until this spring. The group in Zaire, of course, went back. Oh, I suppose we started hearing that there was a spontaneous repatriation starting last, I think, October and November. So it was 2 years of dealing with 2 million people, so that the $1.4 billion is really not a very realistic figure. And what this situation in Rwanda represents is characteristic of something new in terms of emergency operations and humanitarian intervention. It's what we call complex emergencies. Before, you know, there would be a cyclone, or there would be a flood, or maybe there would be a famine. And this kind of emergency was, you could deal with it. There was, within the international community, an infrastructure capable of dealing with it. But lately we've seen, especially in Somalia and some other places, the massive groups of people that have to be dealt with are so huge that they're overwhelming. And usually these emergencies are not as a result of some kind of natural disaster. They are the result of some human-made situation, which usually has something to do with, they're usually political, and they're usually very violent, and they involve massive population displacements. I think we should move on right now to the issue of the Hutu-Tutsi business, because I think that's the thing that most people heard about, and we had these two ethnic groups, and why were they fighting, and what was going on? It's a very, very interesting story, and I'll go back to the beginning of it, which probably started at least 2,000 years ago, even before that. The first inhabitants of Rwanda were probably Pygmies, a group which still exists in Rwanda today. There are three major ethnic groups in Rwanda. The Hutus, who have always been the majority. The Tutsis, who have been the minority. The majority, about 80% Hutu, about 20% Tutsi. And you also see the same population in Burundi, which is the small country just south of Rwanda. It's the same thing. The Hutus have always been in the majority. The Tutsis have always been in the minority. And then there's this small group of people who were these original Pygmy people called the Twa, T-W-A. And they're at the bottom of the pecking order. Okay? Probably the first people who came were the Hutus, were the majority of people. And they were farmers, essentially farmers. And they came about 1000 BC. Then later came the Tutsis, and they were also farmers. Most of them were farmers. But the interesting thing and what made the difference is they were also cattle herders. It's very interesting. You find this all over Africa, and you also, to some extent, if you look back into our own country's history, you see that the people who had the cattle always thought of themselves as being better than the people who were just who just had the land. You know, the cattle herders in the West, they looked down on the sod busters as being really, you know, low class. Well, the same thing happened in this situation, and the same thing happens all across, especially in this area. ELCA used to have some, we still do have some missionaries up in Senegal, and you had the same thing with the guys with the horses and the guys with the cattle were always thought to be much better and much higher social class than the farmers, okay? The Tutsi, some farmers, but also the cattle herders, they consolidated their power through custom and tradition. And they absorbed, but they did absorb a lot of Hutu culture because, of course, the Hutus were the majority, 80%, 20%. They took over the Hutu language, and they incorporated a lot of Hutu tradition and cults. And today, and this is the thing that was so surprising to a lot of people when you really knew the culture, is that the Tutsis and the Hutu, they share a common language. They don't speak a different language. They share a common language. They eat the same kind of foods. They have, in many cases, the same cultural language because they've been living together for so long. And there's been a lot of intermarriage. So in some places, you really can't tell the difference between the Hutus and the Tutsis at all. But what separated them and what continued to separate them throughout all the time was a matter, again, as I said, of occupation and of wealth. The Tutsis were always a little better off than the Hutus. And then there came this, as a result of this difference between the social classes, there became this kind of patron-client relationship, where, for example, a Hutu peasant, he could be given a cow. Usually the Hutus did not own livestock. He could be given a cow. He was given this cow by the Tutsi. In return, he would make himself available to work the land. of the Tutsi. So it was, we'll give you a cow in relation in order to pay back, then you work for us. So it was a patron-client relationship. But the difference in the society was never totally stratified. It was never a situation where you once were a Hutu, you were always a Hutu. If you managed to make it and gather some wealth and get together a herd of cattle or sheep or whatever, you could increase your social position, right? And so it moved both ways. Some Hutus were able to move higher. Some Tutsis had bad circumstances, and they fell down on the social scale. And not every Tutsi did exploit a Hutu, but again, remember what we're talking about in terms of numbers. You've got 80% Hutu, and you've got 20% Tutsi, and the Tutsis have the power and the influence, okay? But over time, there developed a dangerous sense of second-class citizenship among the Hutus. This was clear. The Tutsi nobility had dominated the center of Rwanda. The Tutsis were always very strong in the center, and the Hutus were very strong in the northern part of the country. And then, it's even more strange, the Tutsis stress this idea of the importance of physical stature. Even some of my friends in Tanzania, I am not able to tell the difference, but my Tanzanian friends will say, because there were a lot of Hutu refugees in Tanzania, and some of them didn't stay in the camps, and some of them even managed to get as far as Dar es Salaam, and one of my good Tanzanian friends would say, well, I walked into a restaurant and there was a Hutu. And I'd say, how did you know that this is a Hutu? He said, oh, you can tell. The Tutsis are tall. The Tutsis have rather aquiline features. The Hutus are short and stocky. This is just a kind of physiological thing. And of course, as you can imagine, here are the Tutsis. They're tall. They're, by perhaps Western standards, maybe more beautiful. They've got the cattle. They've got the power. And the poor Hutus are the short, stocky farmers. Okay? The tall was superior. The short was inferior. The people who were short and stocky, who worked the land, who had neither cattle nor ties to the nobility, they became the second-class citizens in Rwanda, and they were 80% of the population. The Hutus said that the Tutsis looked down on them as subhumans. And any Hutu peasants who challenged the system, in many cases, were treated very harshly. The Tutsi nobles were not hesitant to massacre rebellious villages, those who tried to change the situation, who tried to make it more democratic. We have to be very clear about this. The Tutsis were very, very harsh in how they dealt with those people. I think it's also important to point out that a lot of times we hear, and you've probably heard too, that it was all of those bad colonial powers who came to Africa and caused all this ethnic difference. Certainly, the colonial powers who came, and it's clear as I go through the history of this, manipulated those differences. But clearly, those differences were there from time immemorial, not time immemorial, but certainly the class differences were there. They were manipulated by the colonial powers, but the colonial powers did not institute those things. They were already there at the beginning. They manipulated the differences, but they did not invent them. As I said, the Tutsis were the cattle herders. They were the soldiers. They were the administrators in the government. The Hutus were the farmers, and the Twa were at the bottom of the pile, and they were marginalized and they were mistreated by both the Hutu and the Tutsis. After World War I, the League of Nations gave Belgium the mandate to administer Rwanda. And then after the Second World War, with the coming of the United Nations in 1946, the country became a Belgian trust under the UN. after that, during that period of time, there was a monarchy between the time of the colonials coming and the independence of Rwanda in the 60s. There was a Tutsi monarchy there with a king, et cetera, et cetera. But then there's another interesting thing that goes before the independence of the 60s. The Europeans, and here comes the manipulation by the colonial powers, by both European civil servants who came as Belgians to assist in the running of the country, and also the missionaries. We have to be very clear about that. The missionaries also brought with them this very strange idea of what they called the notion of the Hamites, and I find this to be extremely strange. They said because the Tutsis were tall and kind of looked like them, they said that the Tutsis were really these Hamites who had come down from the north. In fact, the Tutsis, it's believed, came from this area. But the further north you go, I don't know if any of you have been in Africa, you travel to in Sudan, Ethiopia, any of these places, it's very clear that the north, the further you get to the north in Africa, the lighter the complexion, the people get taller. Certainly, you know, you can pick an Ethiopian out anywhere because they just don't look, they're tall, their features are rather fine, whatever. So these colonialists, the Belgians and the missionaries and whatever, got this idea that the Tutsis had really come from Ethiopia or Sudan, and that they were literally, I mean, it's an incredibly racist attitude. You don't think of racist attitudes existing within a black society, but believe me, they do. They really do. So they brought this idea that these Hamites had come down from the north, maybe from Ethiopia, and they had come into this dark and savage land in the heart of Africa to impose their superior civilization. So here you've got the colonial powers and the missionaries and whatever really confirming this idea that the Tutsis were superior. The truth is that nobody knows. They think, they're really not sure where the Tutsis came from, but not certainly from Ethiopia. And certainly they didn't come from Europe. There were even some ideas that these people had just kind of stumbled down from Europe into Africa. And it was interesting that during the genocide then, the Hutu extremists who were doing the murdering, who had planned the murdering, they would, to exhort the other Hutus to kill the Tutsis, they said, send the Tutsis back to Ethiopia via the rivers. Mm-hmm. And this is exactly why a lot of the bodies were thrown into the rivers, because Lake Victoria, it goes this way, you see? Mm-hmm. And these Hamite people were supposed to have come from Ethiopia, and there was such a hatred against the extremists had made this tremendous hate propaganda against the Tutsis, and then they said, look, kill these people, throw their bodies in the river, and send them back to where they came from, because they essentially thought they'd come from Ethiopia, but of course they hadn't come from Ethiopia at all. For the Europeans, this was a very attractive hypothesis, this business of the Hamite thing, because one could link physical characteristics with mental capacity. And I think this is the thing that so amazes me about this genocide, because if you look at it, it has so much, there are so many parallels to the kind of thing that happened in Nazi Germany, where I don't know if any of you have had a chance to visit the Holocaust Museum in Washington, D.C., but I would really encourage you to do that if you ever get there, because you see that the essence of the Holocaust was a racist attitude, and you see these incredible pictures of very reasonable and rational people measuring physical characteristics, where they would measure, they would look at the color of the Jews' hair, or they would measure their skulls, or they would measure their noses, and if your nose happened to be this way, then this meant you were a certain kind of person. If it happened to be that way, or if your skull was this big, you had such mental capacity and you were lower on the pecking order. It's incredible. Well, this is the same thing that happened here. You linked physical characteristics to mental capacity. The Hamites, these Tutsis, they were supposed to be the born leaders, and they had a right to a history and a future as nobility. as this minority, 20%. And you hear these incredible, I have a couple of quotes here that really astonish me. This is not Middle Ages, this comes from about 1927. Quote, "They resemble the Negro only with the color of their skin." That's one quote. And then somebody in 1961 said, "Before becoming black, these people were really just tanned." they were tanned, and then they got black. Can you imagine? I mean, this is incredible. Another one said, "His stature, the Tutsi, resembles more closely that of a white person rather than that of a Negro, which in fact it would not be an exaggeration to state that he is a European who happens to have a black skin." A Belgian doctor is quoted as saying, "The Hamites, or these Tutsis, have a distant, reserved, courteous, and elegant manner. The rest of the population, the Bantu, the Bahutus, they are Negroes. With all of the Negroid characteristics, they are childish in nature, both timid and lazy, and often as not, they are extremely dirty." So this racist thesis was expressed in many, many ways. The Tutsis were considered to be related to the Europeans, and therefore the Europeans could work with them. You see, when you're a colonial power, you want to pick out the group that you can work with. And you build up a group, and you say that they are the nobility, and you can work with them. And in this sense, that's what I meant before when I said, even though the ethnic differences were there for many, many years, this is how the colonialists, and also, I must say, the church, and the missionaries, and everybody else, the Westerners, manipulated those differences.
Hey, Carol,
yes, please. If you have any questions, please just ask me. I don't want to blab on forever here.
I'm sure there's some religious differences, too, with tribal, but is there, for the Tutsis then more for Christianity? And Muslim
I don't think it was so much of a Christian-Muslim difference, but I know that, as is usually the case in these situations, the Tutsis had more of an access to higher education. In Rwanda, the major groups are the Roman Catholic Church and the Anglican Church. There are not very many Lutherans there. That's the major difference. And here we have to say that the missionaries were culpable because they bought into this idea that the Tutsis were more intelligent, and therefore there were many more educational opportunities available for the Tutsis in mission schools. I don't believe the situation was so much a religious conflict between Christian and Muslim. It was more this Hutu, Tutsi, nobility, farmer, economic status thing.
But that was existent before the missionaries came, right?
It was existent. It existed
before. I mean, that was a situation that was extant. And so if they had actually tried to raise the Bantu or the Hutus up, they would have been conflicting with somebody. And so rather than do that, they went with the status quo.
They went with the status quo. But
did
you know,
they exaggerate?
What do you mean by exaggerating?
Well, by educating, providing more education.
Oh, yes, of course.
Okay.
Right. It was very interesting because up until a certain point during the colonial times, starting in the 60s, when most of Africa, when most of colonial Africa was becoming independent, the Belgians saw the writing on the wall. They were not stupid. And they realized, how in the world will we continue to have any influence in this country after independence if we continue to hold up this minority of people? So then they did a total flip-flop. They did a total flip-flop and then started supporting the Hutu population. Anything else? Should I continue? Okay. Let's see. The colonial policy, I'll move through this quite quickly. The colonial policies merely grafted onto a foundation that already existed a great potential for conflict. There hadn't been a conflict, but there was a great potential. And you can just see one thing building on another, where as I say sometimes, you know, if you make minestrone soup, if you put in broth and you put in potatoes and carrots and peas and whatever, what you get is minestrone soup. You don't get pea soup. And what when you see the building blocks to this, you can see exactly why it happened. It was very clear that something, sooner or later, very bad was going to happen. Finally, the Hutus got fed up with this. You can see. They got fed up with this. And even before independence in the early 60s, there was a manifesto, the Bahutu Manifesto of 57. It demanded Hutu emancipation as well as democratization. And here is another thing that is quite amazing. If the Hutus had said, okay, we don't want the situation anymore, we are low on the totem pole in terms of political and power in this country, and we want to gain our own share of the power and influence in this country through a democratic means or some other political means, probably, you know, this was another point in the continuum of the history where it could have gone one way, but it went the other way. Instead of kind of asking for power or demanding power in that way, what they did is they turned this whole Hamite thesis of the superiority of the Tutsis against the Tutsis. And they said, because they claim to be these Hamites from the north, because they say, they're really not Rwandans. You see? They're really not Rwandans. They're outsiders. They are foreigners. And therefore, we, the Hutus, we are the majority here. We are the real Rwandese. These people are interlopers. They don't belong here. They don't have a right to be here, even though they have been there as probably before the Hutus. The true Rwandese nationals are us. We are the rightful rulers of Rwanda, and this social revolution of 1959 just simply deepened this ethnic cleavage. Because what they did, what the Hutus did then, was make it a zero-sum game, what we call a zero-sum game, meaning what is good for us will be bad for them, and what is good for them will be bad for us. So that there was no way, at that point, what I said before about some kind of consensus, political and social consensus building, to address the inequities of the past with this 80% majority and 20% minority became a zero-sum game. They said, we're the right ones here, we belong here, the Tutsis have to go. There's no way that we can live together here. We are the real Rwandese, they are the foreign interlopers. It's very dangerous. After independence in 1960, there was a parliamentary election in September of 1961. And here the cleavage, the political cleavage, what you had before was an ethnic cleavage. But then when the ethnicity also carried over into political parties, you also have a very, very dangerous situation. When you define yourself politically on the basis of your ethnic heritage, then you are also in big trouble. Because then how can you have any consensus? If you are, you see it a lot of places in the world. You see it in Northern Ireland. If you're a Catholic, you're here. If you're a Protestant, you're here. If you're this, it's not just whether you want to be. It would be like saying, for us in the United States, if you're a Norwegian, you're a Democrat. If you're a Swede, it's crazy. But that's how it happens. And that also undermines the entire political system when you connect ethnicity to politics. And that's what happened after this election. The Hutus won by 83%. So you can see. And this was corresponding roughly to the proportion of Hutu among the population. In other words, the democratic majority came to be matched by the political majority. And from 1965 onwards, Rwanda became de facto a single party state. What did the Tutsis do? What do you suppose they did? They left. I mean, here you've got eight, the Hutus have 83% of the vote. They have told you in the pre-elections that they are the people who really belong there, and you don't. There's an election, so they left. It was a major exodus of Tutsis from Rwanda.
They went to Uganda?
Yeah.
Okay.
Most of them went to Uganda. I should have the, I've got the numbers here. It was quite amazing numbers left.
And this is in the era of Idi Amin Dada.
Right, exactly. About 200,000 left. There were three different times when Tutsis left. They left in 1959, 59-61, which was after this election. There was another exodus in 63-64, and then in 1973, the Tutsis that were left were excluded from all of the higher education institutions, which gives you, that's also what happened in Germany, as you recall, when the Jews were not allowed to have higher education. But, excuse me, the biggest number left now in 1959, about 200,000 left. They went, as you said, most of them went to Uganda. And this was during the time of Idi Amin. So they suffered under Idi Amin as well. And this just reinforced the fact to them that Rwanda was their home. Even though they left, they were still Rwandese, and they had the right to go home. And they started organizing in Uganda, and let's face it, the Tutsis had benefited very much from the fact that they had access to education, they had access to a lot of things that had been denied the Hutus. So they were a very cohesive community, and what they did is after Amin was overthrown after the war with Tanzania, then they had another dictator, Obote. When Obote was overthrown, by this time the Tutsis had really gotten into the Ugandan military. They had been the group that had helped the Ugandans overthrow Obote. And then when the current president came in, much of the Ugandan army at the highest levels was occupied by Tutsis who had come 15 or 20 years ago. They were excellent soldiers. They're very well disciplined. They have a reputation for professionalism, and they had become senior commanders in the Ugandan army. And it also, as a result of this military experience they had in Uganda in getting rid of Obote and being in the army, they then started what is called the Rwandan Patriotic Front, the RPF. And the RPF was located down here in southern Uganda, and they decided that they were going to come back into Rwanda and throw out the Hutus. So they started making incursions across the border. And this was a very destabilizing situation because they were very good at it. In fact, at one point they probably could have taken Kigali, but the French army intervened to keep them from doing that. So that was a real destabilizing situation in the country as well.
Where was the world support at this time, like communist versus the USA?
Well, of course, it was still going on, but there were bigger fish to fry in the East-West conflict. Nobody really cared too much about Rwanda. They cared a lot about Angola because, my goodness, you know, there's diamonds and there's a lot of good stuff in Angola. They cared more about Mozambique because they were afraid of a number of things there. But again, it was the power struggle between the East and the West. That was being fought out in Ethiopia. Well, because Ethiopia's strategic. Look, you know, you got to get up, you got to get through this sea lane. So whatever happens here is important, but what happens here, it's not important. Nobody cares. So all of this was kind of going on.
But that still contributes to the neglect. Contributes to.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
It was
so
neglect.
It is a policy. I mean, yes. It was an East-West policy of neglect.
It was an East-West policy. Yeah. Nobody really cared about it. But then, let me go fast here because we're almost finished for today. There was then a real collapse of the economy. The government, the Hutu government, was very corrupt. As I said, it had become a one-party state. The president was pocketing a lot of money. Foreign aid was coming into the country, but it wasn't really getting to the people who needed it. The international community was finally waking up and pressing towards some kind of democratic action. There was a lot of human rights abuses. Finally, people were waking up. But the coffee, there was a collapse of the coffee market. About 75% of the hard foreign currency coming into Rwanda was from coffee. You had the Tutsis, the Patriotic Front in the north, coming down and causing problems and destabilizing the situation. And out of this, there was one very, very hopeful situation. And that was that a number of Hutus realized, in the majority, realized that this situation could not go on. They were stuck with a corrupt government, the economy was falling apart, and at the same time, when all this was happening, and again, here's a parallel to what happened in Nazi Germany. The extremist Hutus, who realized that if democracy came, they would lose their power. It's the same thing that had happened to the Tutsis 25 or 30 years ago. The elite realized that if democracy came, they would lose their privileged position, and they were willing to do anything possible to keep that privileged position. And they were specifically up in the north. They were the more of the hardcore of the Hutu population. There were some very realistic and very courageous Hutus who said, we cannot continue living like this. We have to have a country that is democratic. We have to live with our Tutsi brothers and sisters. And so what you saw happening was the start of a very good opposition political party to the Hutu regime, which was made up of both Hutus and Tutsis. So the Hutu elite, who wanted to keep power at all costs, realized that they were not only threatened by the Tutsis and by the Patriotic Front and the army in the north, they were also being threatened by some of their own people who had the wisdom and the courage to realize that the situation should not go on. And it was at that point that the president of the country encouraged the most radical, the most outrageous, the most racist group of Hutus to start forming what ended up being these death squads. They started drawing up lists of names of people who they knew they wanted to get rid of to keep their own power. The president at the same time was talking a different line. He was talking democracy. He was talking reconciliation. And the East African community had finally called the president to Arusha in Tanzania to come up with some kind of peace plan, because they knew that sooner or later this was going to blow. And here, I really have to say something good for Africa. We never heard about this. We never heard that really it was the Tanzanian government that took the lead in trying to bring these two groups together. And the talks took place in Arusha. The president was there. The president of Burundi was there. And it, because of a number of different circumstances, the president was forced to sign this peace agreement. And it called for incredible things. It called for power sharing with the Tutsis and the Hutus. It called for bringing the Patriotic Front into the army. It was really quite an amazing document. In fact, tomorrow or the next time I went away to talk about it in session two, it was really an agreement that ran ahead of the reality. And that was one of the weak points of it. But it was quite a courageous document. When the extremist Hutus found out that the president was going to sign this agreement, and when he signed the agreement in Arusha, he signed his death warrant. On the night that he came back from signing this peace accord in Arusha on his private plane, I think it was the 6th of April, 1994, his plane was shot down. It crashed on the grounds of the presidential palace, and that was the last straw. That was it, because then the extremist Hutus said that Tutsis shot the plane down. Now, how the Tutsis could, as somebody said, how the Tutsis could manage to get anti-aircraft missiles next to the international airport in Kigali and shoot down the president's plane is more than we can imagine. The fact is that the Hutu extremists shot down the president's plane, they blamed it on the Tutsis, and the next day the genocide began. In the next session we'll talk about what happened, how it happened, what could have possibly been done to avoid it, and the lessons that we might learn for the future. We have a couple minutes if anybody has any questions. I'm sorry I talked so
when
long.
Is the next session?
It'll be Saturday.
Oh,
I'm sorry. Yes?
I was wondering, the extremists, you said it was well planned out, so for quite a while they've been writing up lists and planning strategies for what they were going to do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And the other thing I forgot to tell you, in the 30s, in the 1930s, the Belgians had instituted, this was another really terrible thing that happened during the colonial period, which again added to this ethnic division that already existed. The Belgians instituted a system of identity cards. And on the identity card, you were listed as a Hutu, as a Tutsi. So everybody, you knew, it seems very incredible. But the fact is that in every commune, there were lists of people. So you knew who the Tutsis were. All you had to do was go to the local governmental office, and all of these identity cards were there. Of course, people knew who they were anyway. But this identity card especially, they're terrible. They're terrible stories, because even with this issue about, well, the Tutsis are tall and the Hutus are short, everybody had to carry an identity card, and these civil militias, these really horrible, horrible people, would set, one of the first things they did when the genocide started is they set up roadblocks. And so that anybody who came to that roadblock and had to pass had to show their identity card. And if their identity card said T, they were killed. It was just it, right there, right on the spot.
If you're a Hutu married to a Tutsi, were you?
No, didn't matter.
You were a Tutsi.
Yeah, if you were a Tutsi, if you were married to a Hutu, and there are even terrible stories of relatives in the same families of Hutus killing their Tutsi relatives.
Well, what took precedence then, like if there were intermarriage and, you know, generations down, how did you identify when they were halfway between short and tall? I mean, you know, there must have been a fair amount of intermarriage.
There was a fair amount of intermarriage, and I'm not exactly sure how these identity cards, I mean, how long after you've been intermarried, I mean, if these identity cards were started in the 30s, how do you determine who is still a Hutu and still is a Tutsi? But apparently you did. There was a way of doing it. And there were stories, of course, of Hutu neighbors,
you know, people defending. Being slaughtered in the churches, but
yes,
that was a big deal.
And that's the thing, right? It's terrible, because a lot of the Tutsis thought that that's the place where they could go, that that's where they would be safe, but they weren't. And some of the biggest, you're right, some of the biggest massacres. There's a section in this book. This man dedicates this book to the victims of the largest massacre in one of these churches.
I think that's what we remember from.
Yeah. Yeah.
But it was the Hutus massacring the Tutsis. Then the Tutsis came in to relieve the massacre, the army from Uganda.
Right.
They forced the refugees out.
Well,
of
course.
And the Hutus running from the Tutsis
right,
at that point.
Exactly. When the Patriotic Front came in from the north, then of course that was the thing.
That's what caused the refugee.
They were running for their lives, because they knew that these guys were Tutsis, and they knew what had happened. And even if they had nothing to do with the genocide, they knew that the Tutsi army would probably take vengeance on them. In the end, surprisingly, for the number of Hutus who stayed, the RPF didn't. They were and are to this day still a rather disciplined, very disciplined army from their experience in Uganda. So while there were certainly some instances of the Tutsi troops taking vengeance on the Hutus, by and large that didn't happen. But still, of course, if you were a Hutu, you were running for your life.
Is Lutheran World Relief, are they working with reconciliation efforts.
Right. That's one of the things that we're doing. The Lutheran World Federation and our relationship, we're different, but one of the big projects that we're working on right now, and I talked about this a little yesterday to the group, was, you know, when you know this and you realize that this has gone on for so long and the wounds are so deep, to talk about reconciliation is just, how can you do it? So we've decided that the best thing is not to talk about reconciliation. The best thing is to get people in these communities together who are now really suffering, because one of the major problems in Rwanda now is lack of housing. Because you see, it goes back again. When all the Tutsis ran away in 59, and then they exited and a couple other times afterward, they left their homes, okay? They left their homes, and the Hutus moved in, okay? Then comes the genocide. The Hutus run away, and the Tutsis take their homes. Now the refugees, the Hutsis, are back, and they find the Tutsis in their homes. So one of the things that's most important is to construct new houses. A lot of the houses were destroyed, but now the returning Hutu refugees find Tutsis living in their homes. And if you want to talk about reconciliation, how do you talk about reconciliation when people come back and find out that their enemies are living in their homes, right? So what we're trying to do is organize.
Which were their homes to begin with, and even though
the Tutsi government has said that the Tutsis have to move out and let the refugees have their homes back, you know it's not going to happen. It's not going to happen. So what we're trying to do is organize community groups of both Hutus. The Lutheran World Federation has said we will not work with either just Hutus or Tutsis. We will not do that. Anything we do in Rwanda has to involve both groups, and it has to involve working on some kind of project that will mutually benefit the entire community. And that means helping people build homes and helping people build schools, because whether you're a Hutu or a Tutsi, you want your children to be in school. So that's the kind of thing we're trying to do.
Do the children mix okay together in the schools or the communities, or do they have just this totally...
They have inherited, the sins of the parents have been visited on the children. I heard terrible stories in the refugee camps, especially in Tanzania where the LWF was working, that you would go into these schools, one of the things that the UNHCR would do was set up schools for these children. You got 250,000 people there, you have to provide education for the children, and you would go into these schools and you would hear these little kids singing songs about, when we go back to Rwanda, we're going to kill the Tutsis.
It's just so much
weaker. It's just so, yeah.
Do you find kind of an amazing similarity with all, I mean, in some ways it sounds to me like you're just telling the story in Yugoslavia.
Well, yes, exactly. Yeah. There are many, remember the thing, and please, anybody go wants to go. When you tie ethnicity to political structures, you are in big trouble. And that's what's happened in Yugoslavia,
or in but the same kind of the same thing. It goes to the economic interests ultimately.
Yeah.
You know, follow the money.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. It's not a hopeless situation. But when I talk about the next part, you can see there were really times when something could have been done. There are people, especially the French government. The French have a lot to answer for. The United States has a lot to answer for, but the French have more to answer for. They had people in Kigali, in the country, who knew that this propaganda was happening. I mean, on the radio, you could listen anytime on the radio and hear that the Hutus were planning on killing all of the Tutsis.
Well, they're reading the names, right?
Yeah, but people, part of them couldn't believe it was going to happen. I mean, this day and age, how can you imagine such a thing happening? But second of all, the French didn't do anything about it. They had intelligence people there, they had military people, there were reports, there was plenty of documented evidence that something very bad could happen. but they didn't do anything about it. And then when the United Nations pulled out their troops, that was also a very bad thing. And there were some troops that stayed on, some UN peacekeepers that stayed on. And amazingly, even though there were very few, they were able to protect a lot of people. They protected a lot of Tutsis in a stadium in Kigali and also in a hospital. And even though there were very few of them, and certainly if the militias had wanted to overrun them, they could have done that. But there was the symbolic presence of those people there, which were not big numbers, but still they would have been able to protect a lot of people. But
what percentage of the 800,000 that were killed were Tutsis?
I'm not sure, but almost all of them. Almost all of them.
So if did you say it was 4 million people in that country to begin with?
No, I'm not sure what the total population of Rwanda was. I think I've got it here somewhere. But in the beginning, they thought about 1 million were killed, and they said, no, figure was about 800,000. Now they say between 500,000 and 600,000. But when you look at the period of time we're talking about, we're only talking about 3 months. And that was the first clue. And there's not a lot of, and the way they were killed, this was not gas chambers. This was not lining people up and shooting them. This was killing close up. This was killing with machetes and burning and whatever. This was just, some of the stories I wouldn't even want to tell you because they're just too gruesome. But this took time. So you knew that in order to kill that number of people, it wasn't just random. It couldn't have been random. There was a plan. There had to have been a plan to kill that many people in that period of time.
Were the leaders of that that were brought to trial, were they killed?
Well, the United Nations has now set up a tribunal in Arusha, in Tanzania, to bring some of these people to justice. But that goes into another thing I want to talk later, which is the real ethical dilemma that those of us in the LWF who were working in the refugee camps had to deal with. Because when these 250,000 went across the border into Tanzania, some of those people were guilty. They had planned the genocide. And we as an organization, as a humanitarian organization, were bound to help needy refugees. But these people were just terrible. They established themselves in the camps with their own little power groups. And the UNHCR finally said, we have got to separate these people, because they were having a very bad influence on them. And you could see when finally there was this massive spontaneous repatriation of the 800,000 that were in Zaire, many of those people had been kept captive. They had these power structures in the camps that would not let people go. And I can remember we had a meeting in Tanzania just about a year ago. And we were talking. We also knew that something was going to happen last fall because of this Banyamulenge group. They were starting to take advantage of the situation, and there was going to be another problem in Zaire, which of course ended up in the fall of Zaire in Mobutu. But I can remember we had a rather naive staff person, a British guy, who was working in the camp in Goma. And one of our staff people in the Rwanda office is a very, very wonderful woman who happens to be a Tutsi, but she knows the situation very well. And this British fellow was saying, oh, well, you know, they knew in the camps exactly who was who. They knew where the genocide people were. They knew where the bad guys were. And they were solidifying their power. And they were literally holding these refugees captive. And this guy said, oh, I've talked to these people, you know, and they can be reasoned with, and da 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 da. And the Rwandese woman, Angeline, said, the moment, they will be your friend as long as they agree with you. The moment you talk to them at all about reconciliation or peace or living with their Tutsi neighbors, they will kill you on the spot. And that's exactly the way they were. They were some of the worst people that you could ever imagine. And for 2 years,
the international community, the UNHCR, all the rest of us, we were feeding them. It was a real ethical dilemma. And there has been, and out of this whole situation has come a major evaluation of the emergency action in Rwanda and in Zaire and in Tanzania. So the next time, we hope, next time this doesn't, or when we have a situation like this, we'll be able to deal with it. Because how could we, in good conscience, it was a terrible dilemma. There were people who were vulnerable, children, old people, women, and how are we supposed to not feed them and separate the bad guys from the good guys? We couldn't.
Your way to kick them out, huh?
Well, I mean, try to kick them, try to kick them out, and they would have killed the aid workers. They had arms.
Well, but all other situations, I mean, hostage situations, they could kill people. Right. They could make it very difficult for you.
And of course, they were being armed. I mean, in the refugee camps, these genocide people, the Hutu extremists, were being armed by Mobutu. They were getting arms from Zaire. So it wasn't a matter of just trying to go into the camps and separate people. If you wanted to go into that Goma camp and separate the good guys from the bad guys, you would have had to come in with guns, shooting. And that was the only reason that it happened. When this Banyamulenge group, who were Tutsis, who had been living in northern Zaire and saw that Mobutu was probably going to fall, they said, okay, here's our opportunity. They, of course, had been armed by the Ugandans, the Tutsis in Uganda. But they were also very, very disciplined and good fighters. So they were the ones, finally, that went into the camps.
Well, the machinery from the West was getting into place to do exactly what you were saying. Or you don't know how willing they were.
The thing that you have to understand that is that the international community has no will to bring U.S. soldiers or European soldiers or anybody into a refugee camp to do what had to be done. There was no way that the Americans would ever have sent American troops there. The Germans wouldn't have sent anybody. The Scandinavians wouldn't have sent anybody.
Well, it still didn't mean that we couldn't have done it in some kind of surrogate.
It could have been done, but people would have died. Yeah. Americans would have died. So at least what we can be thankful for is that this group of Tutsis, this Banyamulenge group, they did it for us. And as soon as they got rid of this hardcore of Tutsi extremists in the refugee camps, the people just went back. That was incredible to see them walk back home, because they were free.
How many of the bad guys have been brought to justice?
Very few.
How will it be done, or will it never be done?
It's like, how many of the bad guys have been brought to justice in Yugoslavia? Mm-hmm. They're trying. There's one incredible scene in this book when the author goes to the church, this church where the biggest massacre took place, and the survivors of the massacre name the guy who, they all knew him. He was the local official. And he is now in a Tanzanian refugee camp. And the author and the BBC crew that's with him go to this camp and they find him. And it's an incredible scene when they actually find this guy and they say, you were the guy who did this. And he says, oh, no, no, I didn't do that. I wasn't part of that, blah, 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 blah. And they said, yes, you were. We have these accounts, these witness accounts that you did this and you organized this. And they said, within 3 minutes, they knew that they had to get out of there, because this guy had his whole cadre around him, and they would have killed him. They would have killed the reporter and the author of this book, because he just had his whole, he had taken his little power base in Rwanda and put it in the refugee camps, and he was...
I'm surprised they were foolish enough.
Yeah. I'm surprised they were foolish enough to do it. He says, the author says, I looked around and I looked at these people and I said, we have 3 minutes to get out of here with our lives. We better go.
Lucky they got out.